session number 26353, Real Fire.
Albert Hawkins, Real Fire. So, on your way home,
mm-hmm.
Oh, just before, we were talking about people going mad in the camps.
Well, no, not so much in the camps. No, this was after they came home.
Did anybody go mad in the camps or break down a lot?
Not that I know of, no.
Why do you think that didn't happen?
Well, I think basically what it was, because A, everybody knew that we were all in the same boat together, but not only that, we knew that we had the family around us. That was your mates, you know. Each billet, there was 10 blokes. And what happened in there during the routine of the day, basically, was it... If you was billet orderly, as we called it, it was your job, you didn't go out in more detail, yeah? It was your job to wake up in the morning before everybody else, go down the cookhouse, get your hot water, and get your food, yeah? And your sorghum, side dishes, they called it, and sorghum or rice, but mainly it was sorghum, yeah? And it was his job to dish out the grub, and also the water was there, which we had one bowl of water, which we had to drink and wash, so... It is up to you how you wait. You wash very sparsely, believe you me. And it was drinking water, basically. You know? But it was always boiled. Yeah. You couldn't drink any cold water. And when the breakfast was finished and the lads was gone off up the hillside, it was your job then to tidy up the billet, yeah, and to wash out the utensils. Yeah. And all we used to do was just go outside, get a drop of water with the dirt, just make sure it was nice and clean, and then rinse them off, and that was it. And then the day was yours, eh? So it worked out every 10 days you had a day off. Yeah. 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 And you had first pick of the side dish, kimchi as we call it. Whatever was in there. I can remember one time we had a load of pigs come in. And they was dead on their feet anyway, like, you know. And Herbie Ains, I think it was Herbie, he was a butcher. He slaughtered them and... thought I'm going to have some pork, and there was about 6 or 7 pieces of pork about as big as that floating about in water, you know. That was it, you know. I mean, you imagine sometimes they said to us, oh, we're going to have chicken. Well, I think it was a Christmas time, I think, and the amount of chicken in there, well, you know, it was water, a little bit of chicken, that was it, bust, like, you know. It didn't even taste like anything, you know. But at least it was something in there to keep you going, like, you know. But, the old billet orderly, he had first taking. Whatever was in there, that was his first taking, so fair play. So at least once in 10 days, you had a little bit of a taste, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So, on your way home then, quite a long flight, obviously. Days, I imagine.
Yeah. It was days, literally, yeah.
And
yeah.
Where did you come into the UK?
When we landed in England, it was Lynham, in Wiltshire. Yeah, unbeknownst to me, of course. Oh, sorry. When we was in Japan, a Red Cross worker. That's right. Red Cross. A girl came round and said, "Do you want to send a telegram home?" And I said, "No." And I said, "Yeah, if you don't mind." And she said, "What sort?" Took the name and address from Mum. You know, Dad, like. And I wasn't married then. And she said, what do you want me to say? Like, you know, and I thought, well, what the hell do I say? You know, and I just said, kept fit and well, love Albert. You know, and that was it, basically, like, you know. And unbeknownst to me, through SAFA, my mother and my sister, my father couldn't come because I didn't know, but he'd been ill, yeah. So he didn't make it down to see me in. But a neighbour came down. They was waiting for the aircraft to come down, and at the same time that there was a lot of troops coming up from abroad for the Queen's coronation. That was May the 1st, 1953, and the coronation was June the 8th, if I remember rightly, 53. Well, there's a lot of aircraft touching down at Lynham with troops on board to be here for the celebrations. It was a Hastings aircraft that we came home on, and there was an Hastings in front of us. He touched down, of course, everybody assumed that it was us. So there was a big cheering going on as well, like, you know. People was coming off, like, and my mum told me afterwards, like, I said, you never got off that plane. Or said, we was very worried, like, you know. And then, fair enough, eventually our plane come down. And then the walkers, you know, fair enough, that they were off all right. And I was on the stretcher. They brought me off a stretcher. And I had a photograph there with me on the stretcher, my mum's hand, and my sister's hand, and the neighbour's hand. I got my hand out, you know, like this, like, you know, sort of touching me, like, you know. And then they wheeled me away into the ward. And then sometime later, they let, you know, the visitors in, like, you know. And there was my mum, my sister, and the neighbour. My old dear come up to me, give me a bloody cuddle. Like, you know. She was, you know... My sister was a bit weepy as well, like, you know. Well, I felt all right, you know. I knew I was home, you know, that was it, basically. And we spent a couple of hours together, and then they had to go. And then I was there that night, that's right. Then I left there and I went to Tidworth Military Hospital on the Salisbury Plain. I was up there, I think it was about 3 or 4 days, I think. I'm not sure. And I was brought home... Brought from there, actually, to my own house by ambulance, yeah, because of the state law I was in, like, basically, loads and loads of tablets, you know, and whatever, and I was on, May the 1st, yeah, I think it was the end of May. I had to go back to, I was eventually posted to Chester Military Hospital, yeah. I had to go up there, and I was up there, oh, I think it was the October when they let me out of there.
Right. Yeah. And what were they doing to you?
Well, it was basically, when I got into hospital properly, Chester, it was diets, basically. Mm-hmm. And then 1 meal, I would have nothing but fish. Mm-hmm. Yeah, nothing but fish. No chips, nothing at all. Mm-hmm. Fish, yeah. The next one I would have would be meat, all red meat, yeah. And then the next one I would have all vegetables, potatoes and vegetables. But it was small,
yeah.
Small portions. And it wasn't, like, say, 3 meals a day. Mm-hmm. It was something in the morning, something mid-morning, you know, something again and something again. So gradually your stomach was getting used to the, you know, the intake, like, you know. And fair enough, it got monotonous after a while, like, you know, I mean, eating all the same stuff, like, you know. But fair play with that, and the tablets as well, what I was taking. Gradually, I started to, you know, put on weight again, and, you know, that's what I come to.
Your legs improved, did they?
They started to improve, yeah. I could hobble about. It was just like, like a little baby, I suppose, you know, trying to walk, like, you'd be... You know, very uncertain where you're going, like, you know, that kind of attitude. But gradually, yeah, they got stronger and stronger, yeah.
And then lots of other people there in the same position.
Yeah, there was quite a few lads who I had what we call happy feet as well, and it was
happy feet.
Yeah, we used to call it happy feet. Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, how can I put it? It was sort of a burning sensation in your feet, yeah. And the only way that we found we could find comfort when we was in the camp, this was, in the winter, was to get a bowl of water, and an ice cold water, of course, and just literally put your feet in it. You know, how we never got frostbite, I'll never know. But that sort of eased the pain away, like, you know, yeah.
What was that caused by?
Well, that there again, through lack of vitamins, I believe, yeah, malnutrition. But I think it's, now, looking back, I think it might have been something like a person gets gout. You know, and they go through the very same, you know, very similar. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe, I don't know, maybe it might have been gout, but I honestly don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But that was, again, that was through malnutrition, you know, lack of vitamins, lack of food, yeah.
And did you have any psychiatrists or psychologists?
Yeah, when I was at, that's when I was at Rorton. It's just not long ago, actually.
Yeah.
But no, I didn't see one. Oh, no.
Did anyone talk to you about what you've been through?
No, nothing at all. No.
Right, just
no. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there was no, you know, like today, you know, there's a lot of stress elements, you know, and then people talk the way through, like, you know. But in them days, there was nothing like that at all, you know, I mean.
You were having nightmares.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. But basically, it was, in them days, the philosophy was, pull your socks up, get yourself together, you know. Grab hold of yourself, get moving, get motivated, like, you know. But them days, there was nothing like that at all. But gradually, even when I first, you know, I remember when I first got married, many, many times I used to wake up during the night, and the wife would be, you know, or she'd wake me, and she'd be, you've been dreaming again, haven't you? And I'd say, yeah, yeah, you know, fair enough, she accepted it, you know, I mean, there's nothing anybody can do about it. But gradually, now, touch wood, they're gone, yeah, they're gone, so, you know, no problems.
So how long were you in the hospital at Chester?
I was up there for, well, I don't know, about 4 months, I think, 4 or 5 months, yeah.
And but, then, did they send you home then?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I got into a bit of an argument with Moriamo, Captain Clark. As well, when I got posted up there, I was informed, because my parents were Gloucester, right? And there was no way they could get up to Chester to see me, like, you know, without the expense, which they couldn't afford. And I was told that it was going to put me into an hospital closer home. And the only one that was closer one would be the hospital up in the Great Western Road. But that never materialised. Yeah. Anyway, me and this Captain Clark, he was my MO. For some unknown reason, me and him didn't see eye to eye from the beginning, to put it that way. Like, he didn't like me and I didn't like him. You know, it's as simple as that. Although I was still a soldier, as far as I was concerned, my time was finished. Yeah, I'm gone. You can't. The worst thing you can do to me is take me outside and bloody shoot me. And he ain't going to do that anyway, is he? Yeah. So anyway, we couldn't see eye to eye. And I used to go up and say, I want to leave, go and see my parents. No, can I one? Right? They wouldn't let me have a leave, like, not unusual things like that. And I was getting gradually fed up. And I forget, something happened, I forget now. Or one of the sisters, I think it was. Me and her had a bit of a tiff, I think it was. So I went in front of Clark, and he was sat down at his desk, and he starts ramping and raving about, you know, army, stuff like that, like, you know. And I just completely lost it, and I leant across his desk and picked him up with the lapels and put my head into him. He didn't go much on that at all. No, no.
Did you get arrested at all?
I spent a week in the NIC in the hospital. It was just another wing, yeah, basically, and I was slung in there and couldn't go anywhere. The door was locked all the time, like, you know. And eventually, comes up for me, like, and that's right. The first time I went in there, I had two blokes. Usually, what happens is it. One's in front of you, one's behind you, and you march in. And then you've got one to your left, one to your right, and you're in the middle. And he, as I say, he started, so I just put the nut on him. The second time I went in there, I had four blokes. One stood in front of me, one stood to me right, one stood to me left, and one to the beer. So I couldn't get anywhere near him. Oh, yeah, it's a cracker that way. You know, fair enough, I just lost it. It's as simple as that, like, you know.
And,
well, no, it isn't really. You know, but for some unknown reason, he just couldn't understand or apprehend why I was like that. You know what I mean? I wasn't very, you know, jumpy or anything. I was normally a placid person. I still am a very placid person. But unfortunately, there are a few people even today who I've got a very short fuse with. You know, and they only got to say the wrong thing, and I'm there like a bloody shot. You know, it's one of those things. But normally, I'm quite placid, yeah. And as I say, I went before him, right, and miraculously, I was cured. And he was going to send me back to my unit. Eh? He said, where's your unit? And I says, North Korea. And he said, what do you mean, North Korea? I said, well, that's where my unit is. I says, my regiment is in North Korea. Eh? And he says, oh, there must be somewhere else you can go. I says, yeah, Reservoir Camp, Robinson Barracks, Reservoir Camp. Well, the first battalion then, and of course, my first battalion was abroad, but the first battalion then was at Barnard Castle, yeah. And I'd been in this army long enough, thank you, and I didn't want a soldier no more. So I, the headquarters was at Reservoir Camp. So I said, right, Reservoir Camp, and chucked me back into the NIC again. And the next morning, I had all my kit packed. Two MPs come down with the handcuffs, yeah. Marched me to the station at Chester, put me on the train, gave me all the paperwork, and they never bothered to come with me. I get off the train at Gloucester, and this was on a Friday night. It was about, I think it was about 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock. And I had all my kit with me, so I shot off down home, Bangs on the door, like, my old dad lets me in. He said, what are you doing then? I said, leave, Dad. I said, I've been posted as well. I said, where's our camp? He said, when you got to go up there then? I said, oh, I'll go up there Monday. And fair enough, I just chucked my kids indoors, like, had a bite to eat, and then went out to town, a couple of beers. And then on the Monday, I just had to go up to the rest of our camp, and went into the guard room, and there was a bloke there, like, you had no idea what to do. I said, here's my paperwork, like, and I had no idea what was in it, because it was all sealed, like, no. And he said, just a minute, he said, we're going to get the guard commander, and the guard commander comes down. Take him from the CO. I said, okay, fair enough. He said, where have you just come from? I said, it's the hospital, Chester, military hospital. And, all right, he says, follow me. Follows him, gets in front of this officer, and reported to him, like, sir, blah, blah, number, name, rank, and everything. And give him the paperwork. Oh, he said, well, tell me, he says, do you want a soldier? I says, no, I bloody don't, sir. And he says, where's your paybook? So give me a paybook. Oh, he said, you got leave coming. Yeah, so I had 28 days leave. Yeah. And he says, right, yeah, here's your pass. Away you go. And I says, and he said, ask for any money, sir. You know, it hadn't been paid until then. Like, no. Fair enough, he gave me some money. And he said, you'll be year in and year course anyway. He says, about your money. I said, okay. And I went on for the 28 days. And he said, when it's up, come back to see me. I said, all right, sir. And I went back up again to see him. And because I was National Service, and I'd done more than a National Service. Now, one part was arguing, you know, the powers that be, that I'm not entitled to anything because I'm a National Serviceman. Now, the other part is saying, well, but he's done more than his time as a National Serviceman, so he should get something, you know, like a resettlement course and stuff like this, like, you know. So anyway, as all this was going on, I reported back, and he said, look, I've still no news about you, mate. He said, what am I going to do with you? Send me back home on leave. Fair play, he was a great lad. You know, he knew I wouldn't soldier. I mean, if he told me to go and get in a billet, to go and get stuff, like, you know. And he just said, okay, away you go. He said, here's a pass. He said, but when I get in contact with you, report straight back. I says, yeah, I will do. And I was home for some time. Had a telegram come through, went back up there. Of course, all my kit then was left up there. And he said, I've got a warrant here. He says, for you. He says, go up. I forget where it was, north somewhere. He said, you go up there, he says, and you go to this place, and somebody will see you up there. I said, okay, fair enough. So he gets off the train, finds me way there, like, and then seeing this officer, he said, we're going to send you on the resettlement course. And I said, fair enough, sir. And he said, you're would like to be a driver. Because I'd already drove before, but they didn't know that, see. And I thought, well, if I put down driving, they'll stick me in a driving school somewhere, I'll be out in no time and home. And it only took me all the way back down to Blandford, and I had to go back down to Blandford. So I went down to Blandford. I was only there, I think, 10 days, I think. And it passed, no problems. Come back to Gloucester. And as I come back up to Reservoir Camp, the officer there again, he said, oh, I've got another warrant here. He says, you're going back up north for your demob suit. Thank God for that. Well, you know, very happy. And gets off the train, finds his place, and walks in, gives the paperwork. And I came out, I thought I was going to come out as a civvy. I came out, still in my uniform. All I had was a trilby hat, a pair of shoes, a shirt, and a raincoat. Nothing else was left. And then I was back in Civvy Street Light Infantry. Yeah.
So what do you think about the way the army treated you when you got home?
Well, it was same as always, though, army. It's you know, that's the way it's done, that's the way it's run. But, I would say the only thing I had a bit naughty was Captain Clark. I mean, that was one thing which I wish it never had happened, but it did. It's what, you know. But no, I mean, there's nothing, it's the same system now, isn't it? I mean, what can you do? What can one person do against the system? You can't do nothing. Yeah. Yeah.
So you went to Rorton and saw a psychiatrist. This was when you were investigating a
patient. Yeah, that's right, yeah. And
was it one psychiatrist?
Oh, only one, yeah, only one, yeah.
How many times did you see him?
Only seen him once. Yeah, only seen him once, yeah.
And how long was that
Oh, it was about half an hour, I think. Mm. Yeah. But he did tell me that he said, no idea. He said, you're the first ex-POW who I've ever sort of talked to. Yeah. So, and that was, I thought, well, that's a good start, like, you know, yeah. Talking about different things and whatever, but I never got to any conclusion what he thought, nothing at all. No.
So how long did you go on suffering the mental effects of what you've been through?
Some years. I don't know. A lot of years, love. I can't measure it, but it's going on for years. Mm-hmm. Yeah, years. Yeah.
And when you came back to DMOG, you come back to Gloucester, mm-hmm. and you got a job on the labouring.
That's right. Yeah.
How did you cope with that? Could you cope with the hours?
No, I did. I coped with the hours and that, but it was the work I found was very, very hard. Mm-hmm. You know, and I was literally forcing myself. You know, mm-hmm. and. I was literally forcing myself to work. It was just normal manual work, but to me, it was like, oh, I don't know, saying, well, go move that mountain. Well, you know, that kind of action. It was beyond my means, put it that way.
Did you manage to
assist? No, I didn't. No, I had to, you know, jack it in the finish, and then I got the job. Back on the Quamp. Funny enough, yeah, I got a job on the Quamp. Yeah, and that was driving. You know, so that was reasonable. Yeah. Well, it wasn't too much effort, you know. I mean, all it was driving, and it wasn't, I couldn't put it too strenuous, if you like, for the word for it. But then gradually, like, I left that, and I did start in the building properly then, like, and just gradually, you know, built myself up. And it done me the world good. It was punishing, but at the same time, it done me the power good. Yeah.
And you stayed in building?
Towards the latter end, I think, was a... about 10 years, I think, 10, 12 years, what was it, 70, I think it was 76, I think, we had a very, I don't know if it was 76, we had a very, very hot, long summer, 76. And then we had a long, wet spell, yeah, well, of course, during the summer it was great, yeah, but when the wet spell came, we couldn't work because everything was underwater, so reported work, of course, but nothing doing, so, I thought, well, that's it. I'm jacking in this job, I'll find someone else. And I went down to a factory. First time I ever worked in a factory in my life. Mm-hmm. And I worked in there for 3.5 years. Mm-hmm. And I got made redundant there, funny enough. In space of about 6 months, I had about 3 jobs. And each job I started, I was redundant. Mm-hmm. And I thought, this is bloody handy. Like, you know? Of course, I was married then and children, like, you know. Mm-hmm. And then eventually I got another job in the factory, and I was there for a little while. I lost my cool with the boss, got the sack, and I left there. And then I worked in another sort of one-man company job. You know, he was great. I got him moldy, and I was on, oh dear, what they call it now. I forget what they call it now. A machine, anyway. Mm-hmm. It's heating. You know, you cut out by hot flames. Oh. I can't remember the name of the machine now. And I was with him for 3 years. And unfortunately, he moved from Gloucester down to Bristol, mm-hmm. into a bigger premises. And he wanted me to travel with him, but it was too far for me to travel. I didn't want to travel that way. And then I went into another factory job. They closed down, went bust. And then I got the last job I had was office equipment. I was in there, first of all, as a storeman, and then the latter part, I was on nights doing all the orders and stuff, like, you know. And I got to make redundant from there. In between time, I was, you know, whatever job I had, I had bouts of illness, you know, fair enough. Either my back was playing up or my leg was playing up, which I still get problems with this left leg right now. And I went sick, and then fair enough, they called me in the office and said, well, we make it redundant. And they made redundant. That was 1991, and I haven't worked since. Right. Yeah, I haven't worked since.
So you retired?
Yeah.
So how much do you think judge, I know that your military experience, career, how much did that affect the rest of your life?
Oh, well, recently, as you know, we know what I've been going through. I honestly believe that what I had to go through in military life, plus what I had to go to into career, and all through my army career, it sort of, I won't say hard, don't make you hard. It makes you more, what am I looking for? More able to cope, more able to cope with, irrespective whether you have a good day or a bad day, you can cope. You don't sort of burst out or anything. You can cope. I honestly think that has helped me a lot. Even today, it's helped me a hell of a lot. It's still, I don't know, military still even more in me, I suppose. Silly little things. Where I keep my shoes is always in a certain place. When I take my slippers off, they're always in a certain. They're in a certain place. Everything is in a certain place. And
you're obsessive about that, or is that just tidiness?
Oh no, I think that's tidiness. No. And this is, no, I think it to anyone who has never been in the forces, I think it would be a good thing, for them to go in. A, discipline, plus the fact that, A, as I say before, like when I was a kid during the war, we couldn't get anything anyway, so it was impossible to get. Whilst I was in the camps, you couldn't have anything. So when you come out into Civvy Street, you make do with what you got. Make do and make men, that's it, I've never been one for money. If I got money, I got money. If I haven't, I'm not obsessed by money at all. Same as a wife, God bless her, when she was alive, is if we wanted something, I would never go on HP for it. I would save the money for it. That way, I know, okay, I've got it, it's mine. I would never go on HP for anything. No.
Do you bear any anger towards anyone? I mean, you went through some horrible things.
No, not really, love. No, not really. No, I just I just take it as part and parcel of love. It could have happened to anyone. Unfortunately, it happened to me. Still, never mind.
Well, it's been a fascinating tale.
Okay, my love.
Thank you very much for sharing that with us.
Okay.
I'll just say, Albert Hawkins, End of Reel 5.